Welcome back, everybody. It's time again to the Private Investing and Business Hour on OC Talk Radio, where we discuss the insider information that you need to know about raising capital in today's changing environment. So if you're an investor, an entrepreneur, pull up a chair, slip off your shoes, and let's get started here with our host. The host today, Jim Butts from CalCap Partners.
Well, thanks, Paul. And I'm here today with Ian Trutner. And Ian's got a very interesting company that he's in the process of getting out and getting developed. He's not going to talk too much about that today. But one of the things I thought would be interesting is he has been on the trail of raising some money. And from an entrepreneur's perspective, you know, talking to him about what's his experience and what is he doing and how has it been working for him and what kind of suggestions you have, I thought would be extremely useful. So, Ian, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, not a problem. Would you take a minute or two and just give your sort of elevator pitch about who you are and what you're up to without talking too much about your company?
I come from a media background. I'm originally a filmmaker, and I started off working at Walt Disney back in the 90s, and then had a stint at Warner Brothers, and has written for television and produced and directed films. And while I was in the process of doing that, it occurred to me that I was going from project to project, job to job, and without really a significant amount of upside. And obviously it's an incredibly competitive industry, and getting a huge break is like winning the lotto. So I decided I would increase my odds by learning more about how the financial structures work, not just in the media industry, but in general, because it's fairly across the board on how money works in multiple industries. So I went to back and got my MBA, and then shortly thereafter decided to come. I came up with a concept for a technology platform. Now, media guy trying to do a technology platform had its own challenges and pitfalls, but it's been an excellent experience learning from the ground level how finance works, because I think there's no better litmus test. There's no better training ground than really starting with bare bones and figuring out how to get all the pieces connected to really make a project happen or not happen. I've definitely tried and failed numerous times, and tried and succeeded, at least in when it comes to film. And this is an exciting endeavor, and definitely have a lot of do's and don'ts in my mind as to how I proceed forward.
When you were getting started with this, what were the first obstacles that you looked at that really made you sit back and think, oh my God, what am I getting myself into?
Well, fortunately, unfortunately, I was naive when I first started. This business started, it's a technology concept, technology platform, and the company name is Randian. And we started this about 4 years ago, just based on myself and my partner talking about where the media industry is going, how content is going to change. We were naive, which is an advantage, actually, in some ways, because we weren't jaded. We didn't have any lack of enthusiasm. So we just plowed through every possible door we could, and we're able to get a lot of amazing people to believe in us and follow us, you know, without even having a Silicon Valley background. And as a result, we're able to build up a great team of advisors. We went and filed for a patent. And little did we know later on how difficult that it would actually be. And had we known that, it might have actually prevented us from being as gung-ho about it as we were. Now, obviously, we're both more experienced and slightly more jaded, but still without any loss of enthusiasm. I think that Winston Churchill had a quote. He said that success is being able to deal with go from failure to failure without any loss of enthusiasm. And that's the words that we try to live by. But as we gained more momentum and started to gain more knowledge about it, we had to really narrow our focus and narrow our scope based on what it was that we could actually achieve. So it was a multi-tiered process, but it starts off just with an idea, and it's a matter of pushing that boulder up the hill. And once you get it up high enough to a peak, it starts to gain its own momentum.
Actually, I like the idea when you were talking about how you were naive, and maybe naive is good. I actually believe that, because quite honestly, if you would have known more, you might have gone about it differently. You would have probably tried to do something the way someone else told you to do it. And when you got a clean whiteboard to work from, I mean, you might approach things very differently. So that's the first thing I would say about that. The second is, and I've told people this, I really have never learned much from anything that worked right the first time. I mean, everything I ever learned was because everything just blew up. So, and I've told this story when I was at Bell Laboratories, where I was talking to some people about programming, and somebody was asking me a question, and they said, well, what's your biggest concern? I said that I'm going to write the program that's going to run the first time. And it's like, well, why would you think that? I mean, isn't that what you want? And I said, no, actually not true at all. What's the problem? I said, I'm not that good. I'm just not good enough to write a program that's just completely perfect. So there's a problem, but now I know it's not obvious, and it's going to take a long time to figure out where I made mistakes. So I like the idea of starting at something and getting into it and thinking that it's based upon your naiveness. But I think that that was probably a benefit, because you didn't try to go down the same trail that other people had done in the same way that they did, which didn't lead to any success. So you have a business that's based upon something that's sort of new and not really being done. You're obviously, that's true, because you get a patent on it. What are the conversations you were having with people, whether they were investors or potential advisors in the beginning, and how, what kind of challenges were you be given that you had to overcome?
I think the challenge early on was a credibility gap. Again, you know, it's people who are, and everybody has that. It doesn't matter where you came from. Even if you were one of the founders of one of the most successful tech companies out there, then people think that you're dated. So there's going to be challenges no matter what, and it's just a matter of how you decide to approach that. For us, it was a matter of getting people to believe in us that filled gaps that were deficiencies for our own experience. Time after time, one of the biggest issues was, well, who's your tech guy? How are you going to build this? And that, interestingly, was much more of a problem back in 2011, 2012, when we first approached this, than it is now. Now it seems to have come a little bit more full circle, in the sense that technology now is much more accessible, even to common users. You don't need to be a top-tier programmer in order to build a new technology. There are so many tools available to the general public, either just paid plugins and if you think about the internet, there's only so many different ways that the internet works. We were able to get some very good technologists that were able to get us to the next level. We were able to talk to a good legal team. We had some very good people in the media space that introduced us to contacts that were really excited about what we were doing. And now, really, it's less about the technology and it is about the relationships to be able to get this to the consumer market and to be able to scale it. Building the technology 4 years ago would have cost close to $1 million, and to do the same thing is less than $100,000. Right. So, and you can hire any number of programmers to do that. You don't necessarily have to have your top level position being taken up by a programmer. So it's a continually changing landscape, and I think that that's both the very daunting thing and it's also the very exciting thing about how the industry is moving. And in the amount of time that the 3 years that have passed, we've had an opportunity to really check out the competitive landscape, see other people who've attempted to do this before, see other people who have attempted to do it and failed before. And all of that plays into how we approach future success.
This might sound like a strange question, but you had said something. Three years ago, the way it is today, there's just more that's available. Is there a potential that eventually what's becoming available infringes on your patent?
Yes, we've already run up into that, and there was a new precedent set last year by the Supreme Court, and I believe it was pushed by the larger tech companies that changed the law to make it so that patents, I don't necessarily want to say that they have less power, but that it's harder to launch lawsuits, and it's going to be harder to get a patent in the future also for something that's not a mechanical system, because the internet, the patent laws are still very archaic. They're based around people who had certain knobs and levers and spokes and things that went together into something you could actually blueprint on the diagram. But of course, within the context of a computer environment, you don't have, you know, the same type of systems that allow you to be able to track specifically what it has, you know, how one process differentiates from another. So that's something obviously that we've been considering, and it's both a plus and a minus for us. Mm-hmm. The plus side is going to be harder to achieve a patent like the one that we have. And on the minus side, it might be slightly more difficult to defend it. So ultimately though, no matter how good your IP is, it really comes down to your legal team. Mm-hmm. And it really comes down to how quickly you are able to get to the market and start to be able to generate revenue. So those are the things that we're focusing on right now.
Yeah, I think also from your perspective, one of the more important elements is one of the things that a patent does is it provides you a certain level of protection. But what I'm talking about now is protection in terms of your valuation. If everything you're doing is commercially available, then your valuation has to go down because obviously it's available from other sources. So it's not so much in stopping somebody from doing something, although you have to do that if they're infringing. But it's more about this, the more that you are unique, the higher your valuation maintains itself. So that's something I'm sure that you're interested in keeping.
That's correct.
I'm trying to figure out what's the best way to position this question. You're going after a certain amount of money, which takes you out of the angel investing world. So you're going more into the professional investing, whether it's, you know, venture capital or venture debt or even private equity investment banking. And when you're there, tend to be more involved with businesses. So were you able to actually describe what you were doing that was going to be in the future in terms of business for these people that were interested in businesses?
4 years ago, it was a little bit more difficult to describe what we're doing because it wasn't really fully accepted the way that media was going to be changing. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with broadcast media and streaming and new ways that people consume content. Just in a few years, it's changed dramatically in terms of the amount of hours and time people spend watching streaming media versus broadcast television. Yes. And linear versus non-linear and interactive potential versus non-interactive potential. And there was an uphill battle a few years ago, and this was one of the biggest obstacles, was to explain to people what we saw the future as being. And if it didn't align with what people already perceived, then it was almost always a no. Now it's actually easier to explain to people because everybody watches content via streaming now. I definitely watch way more content streaming than I do broadcast. I can't remember the last time I actually turned on the television at a particular time, and except for the Oscars, you know, except for live events, the Oscars and Super Bowl, you know, those are the only things. But when it comes to narrative-based TV shows, why would I change my entire schedule to watch something on a Thursday night at 7 p.m. when I can watch it in the very next day, whenever I want? So I think that now it's a less of an obstacle trying to explain to people what the landscape of media is going to look like. And now the challenge is why us? We get it. Why are you the guys that are going to be able to shepherd this and pull this forward? And it comes down to a simple belief of we like your approach. We think you have a unique selling proposition, and there's not enough competitors out there even to really be able to articulate sometimes the differentiators. The differentiators are really what separates Facebook from the other social networking platforms that went by the wayside. I think that I'm sure that in the early stages, people would say, well, why? Why another social networking platform? We already have that. Even when Apple created the iPod, same problem. Well, there's tons of MP3 players out there. Why are you doing this? You make computers. You make computers really well. Why would you compete in this space? So it is less about, and I think it's going to get more and more like that over time. It's less about trying to create something brand new, because that's really, really hard. It was very difficult a few years ago. As much as excitement we had, it was just too new. It's too new a concept for someone to bite into. But now the challenge is your differentiator enough? And do you have the right elements in place to really be able to be the ones that change this whole system and make it work?
Yeah, I remember the first time that I looked at it. I'm probably on my, I stopped buying iPods because you have smartphones now. But I had an iPod before, well, iTunes was around. But if you didn't have Apple, you were in trouble. So they had a jukebox type of an approach. And the category that it was in was portable hard drive music. That was like interesting. I mean, it sort of described it, but I never thought of Apple in the context of portable hard drive music. So things are changing and sort of get better. So, you know, what are the kinds of things that you're looking at and doing now that you're trying to get closer? You're having, you know, figure out some new things that you're trying to do. What are they?
Right now, the main drive is to create at least far enough into the process so that people have something tangible that they can use and interact with. Mm-hmm. Putting together diagrams, even a patent, and even explaining it to them. You can explain it to them, you know, ad nauseum for 2 hours, but there's nothing better than being able to throw something in someone's hands and allowing them to see it. That's what we're driving toward right now. We had an opportunity a few years ago, and this was something, again, where you just have to put yourself out there, and then an opportunity comes to you that you're not even expecting. One of our advisors invited us to present at the Variety Venture Capital Summit back in 2012 with the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge. Now it's the Prince and Princess, mm-hmm. but they're the Duke and Duchess at the time, and it was the first time that Duchess Kate was coming to the United States. And they wanted to present them with several companies that had technology that might be of interest for them for UK trade and investment. We were asked to be part of this group of very established tech companies. Hewlett Packard is one, and Qualcomm is another, and then there was us. It was a two-person company, and so and at the time we were still very nascent and trying to put things together. But what it forced us to do, we were told we only have 2 minutes. You have 2 minutes to present to them something.
This is the elevator pitch. We had to put together something that within less than a minute explained the entire process that we were attempting to achieve. And we were able to do it. And as a result, the 2 minutes that we were supposed to have with the Duke and Duchess ended up stretching to about 7 or 8 minutes because they were so interested in what we were doing. And so I think a lot of those, like I said, the naivety was helpful early on because it forced us to put ourselves out there. We were having people sign NDAs and all of those things, but at the same time, it didn't stop us from just putting ourselves out there. As a result, it forced us to be able to refine our pitch to the extent that we were able to pull that off and gain a lot more interest in investors also.
You know, look, things are so different back in 2012. I know that at the time we were looking at doing a roll-up of wireless internet service providers, and one of the rationales was because it was a belief that in 2015, 15% of the traffic on the internet was going to be from wireless devices. And a lot of people, I didn't think that it was crazy, but a lot of other people thought that it was. Who would have come up with the idea back then and known that there's a whole demographic called millennials that only use cell phones? They only have a smartphone. That's all they care about. That's all they look for. And they check it 300 times a day.
Right.
So there's this whole demographic that's like the next generation that, you know, if you can't take care of them, or the fact that there's 5 billion smartphones right now, and it's projected in 2 years there's going to be over 7 billion. So there's going to be more smartphones than people on the planet. No one could think about that. But, you know, it's nice that you're in a place where you can anticipate how you can benefit from that and explain it. Did anything actually more come out of that presentation?
A lot of meetings with investors that we're still in touch with, and that could potentially invest. It's a venture capital summit, so venture capital tends to be larger money. At the time, we were looking for smaller increments of money to just try to build the proof of concept and platform out. Okay. But I think it really, when you have an opportunity like that, it starts to build credibility for yourself too. Because it shows that someone believes in you enough that they're going to put you out there. And of course, our advisor who gave us that opportunity, he didn't want us to fall flat on our face, especially in such a high profile event. I mean, it's all over the news. So it really gave us the faith to know that we can effectively in under a higher pressure type of environment, deliver a message that people will quickly grasp and understand. And with that presentation, too, we're able to show it to numerous investors and still use the same presentation to this day because it hasn't really changed conceptually from what we had originally. I think that the only thing that's changed for us is that we started to narrow our focus on where it is the highest monetary value of this ecosystem would be, because it's a large concept. Right. So, and you don't have to create the entire ecosystem. Elements and pieces of it are already in play. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of how do you find that need niche? How do you find that one component that people want, and it's becoming part of the consciousness of the mainstream, and provide them the convenience that will make their lives slightly easier, slightly better. Because ultimately, I think that convenience wins the day. If you can make someone's life just 2 seconds more, I mean, think of the iPhone. The iPhone didn't create the phone. They didn't create the GPS. They didn't create text messaging. They didn't create games. They didn't create most of the things that you actually use on your phone. What they did is they stuck it all in one device. And so now instead of, you know, backpack full of stuff, you can just fit it in your front pocket. So that's the core of what we're attempting to do too, is to make something that people want just a little bit easier to do.
Well, it ends up that we just about talked our way through the entire segment. If anybody wants to get in touch with you, is there some best way to do that?
Sure. They can go to to our website, randian.com, and there's links there to be able to reach out to myself or my business partner, Ian at randian.com.
Would you spell Randian?
R-A-N-D-I-A-N.
Well, Ian, it was great talking to you. We've spoken before, and I'm really interested to see where you're going with this product, because I think it's a game changer. And maybe we'll have you back when you can talk more about it. But I appreciate you for being on the show.
Absolutely, Jim. Thanks for the opportunity.
All right. Before our second segment here, let's do a quick shout out to our sponsor of today's program, CalCap Partners. California Capital Partners, LLC, is, in fact, manager of a variety of venture capital funds, specializing in investing in small to medium-sized technology-based businesses with high growth potential. CalCap manages equity and debt investments, and also has a variety of different people within their organization who collectively have raised over $2 billion with successful outcomes since the 1990s. They also have operations here in the U.S., California, New York, and Canada, Ontario, and British Columbia, to be specific. And they also, of course, bring a global network of strategic resources consisting of managerial talent and capital resources that add value to their portfolio companies. And perhaps most interestingly, they have a proprietary investment process that enhances outcomes for both the investors and the portfolio companies. They call it SIMS, Sourcing, Evaluating, Investing, and Monitoring System. It's their own proprietary in-house system developed over many years, and it helps them to achieve their goals. So if you want to talk about all the world of venture capital and raising money, if you want to learn more about their specific services or the venture capital funds that they oversee, why not give them a call? Start by going to the website, CalCap Partners, that's plural, CalCapPartners.com, and I'm sure they'll be happy to tell you more. All right, let's pick it back up, second half, with Jim Butts.
Well, thanks, Paul. Welcome back to the show. I'm here today with one of my other partners, Mark Burton. He's been on the show a couple times with the mailbag. Today, Mark's going to do the first of three segments that we're going to talk about mergers and acquisitions, and that's in Mark's wheelhouse. So, Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me back, Jim. I appreciate it.
Why don't you take a couple minutes and talk about your experience with mergers and acquisitions and the kinds of things that you think are important?
Okay. You know, it's funny because it feels like almost my entire professional life has really been around business transitions and mergers and acquisitions. I started off my professional life as a corporate finance and securities attorney specializing in mergers and acquisitions. Mm-hmm. I went on to become certified by Loyola of Chicago in M&A, as we call it, and I'm also certified in business valuation. And I spent most of my career as either as in-house counsel and often also as head of development for a series of M&A shops, investment banks, and business valuation firms. So it's a topic that not only is near and dear to my heart, but probably part of my soul at this point.
I'm a company, an entrepreneur, and I've got my company and it's running well. I'm always going to look for an exit strategy. I mean, that's one of the reasons why you start a company, especially in high tech. Mm-hmm. What are the things that I should be thinking about or planning as I'm putting the company together and getting it up and running to facilitate being acquired by another company?
You know, this is particularly important for folks who are just starting out. I think the question that you want to ask yourself right off the bat is, how long till I exit? What are the milestones that I'm going to make that determination to be? And for some folks, that determination is based on years. You know, I want to exit in 10 years, I want to exit in 5 years, I want to exit in 20 years. For other people, that milestone changes, and it's based on either revenue or EBITDA. And for those who may not know, EBITDA is a way of calculating your real profit, what you really take home from your company on an annual basis. But regardless of which of these milestones you choose, and you really should choose one or the other, you should also be thinking about, how does this exit going to look? There is a difference when we're talking about private companies. By the way, the most common exit period is to die. That's really not a great exit strategy. You don't really get the value out of the company that you're looking for, but it is the most common. What you really want to do is get purchased. And there's two specific sets of purchasers. There's financial purchasers and strategic purchasers. And I don't think it would shock if I said that strategic purchasers typically pay more for a company. When you are beginning to either create your company with an eye to an exit, or when you are at that point where you've made the decision that you're going to exit within a certain period of time for whatever your personal reasons are, I would think about first, which of these two would you rather go with? And there's different reasons to go with each one. Mm-hmm. And second, I'd begin to think about who might be your purchaser. Let's say it's a strategic, and they tend to be a little easier for this process. If it's a strategic, I would think about who are the top three or five possible acquirers of your company. And I would use that as a guideline to begin to prepare your company for the possible acquisition, for really putting yourself out there to make it known that you'd like to be purchased.
You know, one of the things that's I've always been interested in is, a lot of times in venture capital, when we're talking about, you know, what you're looking for in terms of an exit, based on revenue, multiples of revenue. But in other areas like private equity and some investment banking, people are using the EBITDA number. And I always found that interesting because you can play with EBITDA. You can make EBITDA look bigger or smaller depending upon what you do inside, but you can't change revenue. So what is it about EBITDA that makes people interested in that?
The argument over whether you can really move EBITDA around all that much, I hear that a lot of times. I only agree with that up to a certain point, because really, at the end of the day, a purchaser is going to probably take a very conservative view to your EBITDA calculations. Mm-hmm. And so if you're conservative, you'll have a pretty good idea of what that number is going to look like. Now, as to why we love EBITDA, because it's what we really get to take home. Mm-hmm. If you are a strategic purchaser, say a competitor or someone in an ancillary industry segment that wants to get into that industry, well, revenue may make more sense because you can cut certain expenses and you can increase your EBITDA by that. But if you're a private equity, you're all about return on investment.
Right.
And there's the number that you get to take home. There's the starting number that you get to try to grow. But that's really, at the end of the day, it's, in my opinion, with a few exceptions, it's all about EBITDA.
Yeah, you know, week before last, actually, John and I interviewed Arthur Lipper. And he was talking about using royalties. And one of the things that you brought up was, you know, in a lot of cases, if you're being an investor, and one of the things you want to look at is in the company, what is it that they're doing for their executives? Are they buying them Mercedes or are they buying them Hondas? I would much rather they buy them. He said, I would much rather they buy them Hondas. But it's kind of like you can see what happens if you buy 10 Mercedes for an executive team. All of a sudden, your EBITDA gets really decimated as opposed to if you were to buy the Hondas. So I appreciate that. And actually, I one of the places that I've liked to use the term EBITDA, when I looked at a lot of consumer products businesses, when you're looking at, you know, what's happened in terms of acquisitions, the multiples that I saw last time I looked was somewhere between 0.65 times fifth year EBITDA, revenue actually, but it got the EBITDA three times. And, you know, some person I was talking to about it said, well, that's terrible. They're not even going to give me one times my revenue during that year. And I said, no, you don't look at that. You look at the EBITDA. How much, you know, that's how much you get to take home. Somebody's possibly offering you five times what you would have normally gotten in terms of EBITDA, or they're saying you could operate your business for the next 5 years, and this is what you would get to take home. I'm going to give it to you in a lump sum. And the person said, well, you know, that doesn't sound so bad there, but, you know, where do you get to 15 to 20 times? And I said, you're in the wrong industry. It's not my fault that you chose to be in a consumer industry. But I always found it interesting that, you know, if you're talking to one group of people versus the other, and sometimes when I'm listening to two different people, I'm like automatically translating numbers in my head because this one's talking multiples of EBITDA and this one's talking multiples of revenue. But I find it interesting. So what are the kinds of things, you know, you talked about if you're going to do this and you're the entrepreneur, then you really want to look at things like, you know, who is a possible quarter to buy your company? And then, you know, is there some suggestions that you can give them about how to find out, first of all, if they purchase the kind of companies that you're into, that you're involved with, or about what they pay for them? Is there some place they should look?
Well, the answers are yes and no. And those are really two very different questions. So, you know, the first question is really, gosh, how do I determine who might be a good fit to acquire my company? And that one is fairly easy. Trade shows, your competitors, your suppliers, folks that you deal with on a regular basis. Now, understand something. I'm not suggesting you wander over to a competitor or to a vendor and say, hey, I'm thinking about selling out. Are you interested? That's a disastrous approach. Do not do that.
Right.
This should be a highly confidential transaction, at least until it's completed. But by simply talking to people, people love to talk. They love to talk about their business. Even your competitors will tell you some things. They won't tell you everything, but they'll tell you some things. And if they've been on an acquisition spree, chances are that they're going to be gleefully telling you about their most recent closing.
Mm-hmm.
So from that perspective, it's just being involved in your industry is a great way. Another way, I say this with a little bit of hesitation, is go out and reach out to some investment bankers. Now, the reason why I have hesitation there is there are certainly investment bankers who know your sector, and if they're ethical, they won't tell you the names of their clients unless they've been allowed to. But they'll at least be able to give you a basic idea of what your industry is looking like and where you fall into it as far as desirability. Now, the other question you asked me was, well, can I find out what basically my multiple is on EBITDA? And the answer is yes and no. There are databases out there that have tons and tons and tons of multiples and values by industry. However, you know, unless you're a business appraiser, and even then you'll find most business appraisers don't put a lot of weight into this approach of comparables, because reality is the databases don't really have that much information. They have a limited amount, and that amount can actually be a little bit deceptive. So you could see a transaction in your industry where it says that somebody that had $1 million in EBITDA and $10 million in revenue got a four times multiple. They sold the company for $4 million. Let's talk about what they didn't tell you. They didn't tell you that there was a consulting agreement with the owner to stay on for two more years that was worth another $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
They may not have told you that there was an earnout that had a theoretical value of somewhere between another $1 and $1.5 million. So, you know, you thought, oh, my company is only worth $4 million, when actually someone was paying someone else closer to $6 million.
Right.
On the other hand, they might have that $4 million and not tell you that there's what a moving earnout, wherein if certain numbers aren't hit, they'll actually get less than $4 million. They won't make that entire amount of money. So the devil's in the details for really knowing what the real value is. And that also hits a point that when we talk about value in the sale of a business, it's not a specific point on the chart. It's not $4 million or $5 million. It is movable based upon the structure of the transaction. The more money that you want up front, the less the total value is going to be.
Right.
The more of a chance you're willing to take by way of an earnout, by way of a note, a promissory note, the bigger that number will probably be.
You know, there's a couple of things you said that brought some thoughts to mind. One of them is, I was actually, when I was with Lucent Technologies, when we were spun out, I was actually in the organization that made the first acquisition, and we bought a company. And I learned a lot during that period of time. So one of the things that I found was that if either one of the companies that's involved in the transaction is public, and any decision was made about going forward, you had 24 hours to get the information out publicly.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time, in this case, a lot of people thought when they heard it that I was involved in it because I was in California, but I wasn't meeting with this company. I was meeting with Qualcomm over something else. But that was the first thing that was interesting. The second thing was, right around that time, they had hired someone who had graduated from Wharton, and they asked me if she could report to me. And I thought that was great because she was really very smart. And she was the one that taught me all about financials. And one of the things that she said was, look, if you're going to look for valuations of companies, if one of them's public, anything that they do, it has to be, they have to actually identify it to the SEC. So mm-hmm. if somebody makes an acquisition, now you might have to find out where it is, but they filed something, an SG-13 with a significant change in ownership. And there's a lot that can be said in those things that you would have never found out. In one case, there was somebody came out and they said that they got a whole lot of money. But when you looked inside of it, it was really a stock swap for most of it. And there was some other things that were just not cash related. So there's things that you can look at. The last thing that I would say is one thing that I found that is very useful is go to the company that you're looking at and go to their press releases and go back in history and see if they talk about anything.
Let's see if they've had successful transactions mm-hmm. in the past. You said something very interesting. You said basically stock swap.
Mm-hmm.
And I just recently was pulled in on a deal, and we chose not to be engaged, as you know, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
But we were looking at an international deal where a company had received stock from a much bigger company.
Mm-hmm.
The bigger company was going to go public. They were going to do a reverse merger, which, frankly, is not a wonderful idea with the certain exceptions, some very rare exceptions.
Right.
But this stock, this company, put off on raising its own capital or debt. They thought, oh, we're going to get this huge cash infusion because these guys are going to buy us, and they're going to give us stock in their company. Yay! Well, the company that was supposed to buy them didn't go public. The transaction was pulled, and these guys were left high and dry.
Wow.
So, you know, we'll talk about this probably in a later segment, but there is as much due diligence to be done by the company to be acquired as there is by the company doing the acquiring.
Absolutely. I think that's really true. Some other things that people should consider.
You know, when you are looking at a company, or preferably several companies, that are going to possibly be your targets to purchase you, and you have a good feeling about them, I would start moving some of your processes over towards something that's complementary towards them. If you can find out what accounting systems they're using, or at least what accounting processes they're using, you can check to see if your supply chain is a good match for them. Give them every reason to want to do the transaction. Make the integration, everyone forgets about this, integration of the new company, the company to be acquired by the acquiring company, the end of the transaction is really just the start of the work.
Right.
Now they have to integrate. So what can you do to make your company look easily integratable?
Mm.
You know, that's a tough one, by the way, for when you don't have a clue as to what your targets are using for their accounting systems, for their payroll systems and all this. Then what I suggest you do is determine what the industry standard is, you know, and go with the industry standard. That way, even if they're not on the same process that you are, at least they're going to be familiar with it and they can make the transition over much easier. Also, make sure, especially for those 3 to 4 years where you're preparing to be acquired, make sure that you really go what I call going corporate. This is a case where everything goes on the books financially. I know a lot of even very successful middle market privately held companies, they occasionally take some cash out, and we call it gray income. Don't do that anymore. Every time you take out gray income, you've wiped out value from your company. Make sure that everything is really on the books and by the books. Make sure that your human resources guides are up to date, that all of your manuals are up to date. Make sure all your corporate documentation is up to date. Make yourself as pretty as you can, because going through that due diligence process is tough, and there are things that you would never have thought of that may catch you out. Be very aware of pending litigation that you may or may not know about. If you even think there's a possibility of litigation, pay attention to it. Make sure your taxes are completely paid up. Really clean shop.
Right. I think that's actually some pretty good advice. The other thing that I know about, at least in a couple industries, if you're in, let's say, in a software internet business and you're growing up, if you get to be, you know, over $100 million in revenue and all of a sudden you're worth 10x your revenue, there's only about five or six companies that have the ability to buy you nowadays. And they're the same five or six. However, if you have a plan that you're going to be acquired and you wanted to start shopping at around $50 million, all of a sudden the number of people who can think about purchasing you expand significantly. I mean, even brands can buy you at that point in time, and you could have an easier time being acquired at that level than it is to try to get it up over $100 million. And then you got two choices, one of six companies, and we can name them, or go to do an IPO. Might be a little bit more difficult, might take a lot more time. So it's also another thing to consider, what industry am I in, and what's the landscape for things like acquisition? What's happening in that industry? There's a couple reports that come out to talk about various mergers and acquisitions, and we'll tell you on a quarterly basis what kinds of things are going on. It's something that, if that's what your exit is, I would start looking at it after you get, you know, about 2.5 years into the business, where you start to really looking seriously about what am I going to do with this longer term.
I absolutely agree. And you brought up a very interesting point that a lot of people forget about. Well, A, yes, the bigger you grow, in theory, the more value you're going to get for your company. But there's a certain point when you begin to move out of the lower middle market into the what's called full middle market, or large, really the large end of the middle market, where you nailed it. The number of buyers for you is diminishing.
Right.
So the offset to that may be either, you know, the biggest fear of all is everybody says no. No one wants to come play at your party. The other side of the coin is they may say, well, we're only willing to give you this much of a multiple because we know for a fact that we're the only game in town.
Right.
You may have actually done better, at least on the multiple versus EBITDA basis, when you were still at the low middle market arena. Yes, you may not make away with as much money, but you're going to have a lot more wiggle room to negotiate.
Yeah, I have no problem agreeing with that. I mean, that's so true. Yeah, it's the basic laws of economics come into play. There's a limited number of buyers, and then all of a sudden there's more and more items for sale. Well, those buyers pick and choose. I mean, the fact that Yahoo might be sitting on so many billions of dollars doesn't mean that they're willing to buy you or Facebook or any of the other ones that are the big players. They're shopping, and they know that it's the old thing about you go by the golden rule, he who has the gold rules. So it doesn't mean anything about what you're doing with your business, and it's great that you got a great story. Plus, you're going to pay a lot more when you're at that level to get yourself all dressed up to be sold than you would a year earlier, a year and a half earlier, when you were just at that $50 to $75 million mark. You know, you could have been in your second business by the time you got to the point where you're trying to sell your first one. So,
you know, and one more thing I want to raise here, strategic planning.
Yeah.
A lot of folks really kind of go through the strategic plan, and what they think of as they do it is, this is just how I'm going to grow my company.
Right.
When what they should be thinking of is, this is how I'm going to grow my company, and this is how I'm going to prepare my company for sale. So you don't just do the research on the markets that you're entering. You also do your research on your competitors, not only for marketing purposes, but for potential acquisition later purposes, either them acquiring you or possibly you acquiring them.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll tell you, this has been interesting. And would you believe that we've already just hit that 22-minute mark? So we're going to continue this again in the next segments for next week's show. And Mark, I appreciate you being on the show and look forward to continuing the conversation.
Jim, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Great.
You've been listening to the only show that talks about the real-world examples, the real-life stories of venture capitalists today. It's the California Business Investing Hour, brought to you by CalCap Partners, right here in Orange County's only community radio station, octalkradio.net.